Welcome to the C Word, the Conservators podcast. Today we're talking about conserving the sacred. Join Liz and Fedra and a special guest host to discuss the topic.
Hello, I'm Fedra. I'm a conservator of antiquities based in Nicosia, Cyprus.
I'm Liz Hebert, a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Hello, I'm Aisha Fuentes, and I'm an objects conservator specializing in archaeological and ethnographic collections, and I am based in Cambridge, England.
To begin, I am very curious to find out a little bit more about your background, Aisha. So where did you do your studies? How did you get into objects conservation and particularly archaeological work?
I actually started, it started with my upbringing. So my dad is a carpenter and my mom grows food, and I grew up, you know, making quilts and knitting and things like that. So I grew up in a very hands-on way. And then I got a degree in fine arts, in art practice. And that was from Williams College. And then also religion. So I got, I guess in the UK, we call it joint honors. In the States, we call it a double major. So I studied both art practice and religion at Williams College. And you know, you would never think that's going to come to anything. And to be honest, I don't think I thought it was going to come to anything anyways. I wasn't really thinking about that. I just thought what would be interesting. And then there was a long period where I thought that was it. So I'm the first person in my family to go to college. So to go for an undergraduate degree was already pretty good. And then fast forward quite a bit, and I started to become interested in mount making, actually. So I was working in display fabrication. I started thinking mount making is interesting. And I thought, well, I was good at school, so maybe I could do conservation as well. And I originally thought, well, my background was in painting, so I studied paintings as an undergrad. So I was like, oh, I'll do paintings conservation. And I found someone who very generously took me on for like paid work. You know, it was like a paid intern, and that was amazing. So I started with, you know, your varnish removals and your surface cleanings and your things like that. And I did that for a couple of years, and I thought, oh, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And then I decided to go to school for conservation, as you do in the States, where we have a, you know, formal training programs and things like that. And I was thinking again, I was like, oh, I'm probably going to do paintings conservation. And then I went to school, and I decided to get a master's in art history as a way to get my, because you have to have a bunch of prerequisites to get into conservation school in the States. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, okay, I'll do my chemistry at the same time. But I ended up getting an internship in objects conservation at that time at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And I was like, oh, this is slightly more interesting. And what was also interesting about that is that, and I can come back to this, is that Boston has a large Egyptian collection. And at the time, I remember overhearing people talk about whether or not they were comfortable working with the human remains.
And yeah, always a big, big discussion.
Yeah. So that I thought that was really interesting. I was like, oh, that's interesting if some people are or are not. So at this time, I was doing objects conservation, and I was kind of leaving. I was kind of getting bored with paintings a little bit. I was like, oh, maybe I like objects more. But then I was also interested in this issue of human remains. And I took the opportunity while I was doing that master's. I started studying the use of human remains in Tibetan and Himalayan ritual objects. So I did an art history dissertation on that at the same time that I was looking into conservation schools. So then I started, you know, going around and doing the interviews and things. And I knew I was really interested in ritual objects. I knew I was interested in human remains. I knew I was interested in religious objects, relics, things like that, that were a little trickier as kind of material cultural categories. So when I was going to the different programs and stuff, it was always an option to kind of continue working on material religion or continue working with archaeological ethnographic collections. But then when I interviewed at the UCLA program, obviously that was their focus. And I think also the fact that it was based on the West Coast, which is where I'm from, there was a lot more infinite kind of integration into, I don't know, a more complex version of the United States that I was, you know, more aware of. That was how I ended up specializing in it. And I once I started working specifically on archaeological and ethnographic collections, I realized that it's such a stupid material cultural category because it's literally everything. And the way that I usually will introduce it is say like stuff that's used. I think that the ethical complexity of of working with that those kind of materials is really what draws me to them.
So you mentioned specializing in ritual objects. Can you define for us a bit what do you mean by ritual objects? What makes
Sure.
an object ritual?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a really good question because it's completely misguided. I think there's a, it's like I just finished a stores move project at the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology here at the University of Cambridge. So I did like a 3-year postdoc just working as a conservator in practice as part of their stores move project. And they have, these like material categories. So it'll be like ceremonial object or ritual object or personal adornment or so whatever. And there are these curatorial categories that have come out of the disciplines that have shaped the collection, right? And I have there's an incredible team working on this project. And there was a woman named Eleanor Beeston Sheriff, who's a she was she is a musician, and she was one of the collections assistants. And we were talking about ritual objects, ceremonial objects, sacred objects, whether or not something is ceremonial, a ceremonial instrument. And she was saying, for example, you can have a cello, and the cello can be used to play Rule Britannia, or it can be used to be played Happy Birthday. So the cello can be used as a ceremonial instrument. It can also be used as just a regular musical instrument in any kind of social setting. And I think that's a really important thing about a ritual object as well. So like when I was doing my PhD research, I was looking at, again, the use of Tibetan human remains in Tibetan and Himalayan ritual objects. And one of the first things that I had to look at, for example, was the kind of confusion of what do we mean by a relic versus versus human remains? What do we mean by relic versus a funerary object? And trying to be very specific about how an object was used in a particular setting or for a particular function. And the fact that these objects, most of these objects, will have several different identities and functions, depending on who is interacting with them and what it is that they expect of it. So when it comes to whether or not, what is a ritual object, it's anything that's being used in a ritual setting for a ritualized activity. And if you want to get into a definition of activity or of ritual, then I guess I would look at, what was his name? Amin, I think. Tamir Amin, who describes ritual as the performance of both identity and discipline, which is something, it's drawing from anthropology, it's drawing from religious studies. I also spend a lot of time reading religion, so yeah.
I was actually just going to say, it sounds like your work definitely intersects a lot with anthropology in particular, and especially the breakdown of the definitions that we're talking about now. I assume that you get a lot of that language from anthropology.
Absolutely. And it's really funny as well because I have a really adversarial relationship with anthropology as a discipline because they're convinced I'm not an anthropologist. And I'm like, yeah, fine, fair enough. I'm not. I'm a conservator
Because you don't have a degree.
because I don't have a degree in anthropology, but
Right.
I've now spent 15 years going through the things that they've collected, through the disciplinary lens of anthropology in various settings, not just here in the UK, but in the US and other places as well. So no, I'm not an anthropologist, but I sure know a whole lot about your dirty laundry.
Yeah, I often say that conservators were really polymaths. I mean, we know a lot about
Yeah.
completely random subjects, and we specialize in other fields, in order to be able to conserve the objects that we conserve at the
Yeah.
end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the joy of our job, is that we're constantly being asked to learn something.
Completely. I completely agree with that. Yes. That's honestly what drew me to conservation in the first place, was the idea that even, we're talking about larger academic studies and pushing that forward, but even just interacting with each individual object that you come across as a conservator, you have to you learn something new by working with it and conserving it.
Indeed, and you can have especially with let's say sacred and ritual objects, you can develop a very close relationship with the objects and the people who are considering these objects ritual. You might also work with secrecy. So you can tell me, Aisha, if you've experienced something like that. But I assume, for example, you're talking about Tibetan ritual objects and remains. I assume that you possibly have conserved objects that are kind of secretive, or they're not necessarily shown to the people venerating them or to the public freely and constantly.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting that I have worked with objects that are not normally showed openly, but they aren't necessarily the ones that you're thinking of. And that is a whole other discussion about kind of Buddhism and conservation ethics that I've written about and spoken about and kind of keep circling around on. But the issue of whether or not something can be shown, there's definitely like religious reasons for that. So, museum people are often asking about the human remains. And I've had to speak of them, especially the relationship between ritual objects and human remains in Tibetan and Himalayan material religion. And trying to define what human remains are is just as difficult as trying to define what ritual objects are, because they change according to who they are. But the issue of whether or not something is secret or sacred, it was a huge part of my dissertation and still a huge part of my work related to that, to say that even if something is secret and sacred in a Buddhist ritual setting, it still has like a structure, like an architecture for its interpretation. So there are ways in which your access to these objects might be limited, but there's also ways in which it's facilitated. So you have, for example, a vessel made out of a skull, and it's something that's only used by someone who has very specialist ritual knowledge. But they might use it to publicly distribute something that's meant to have a public benefit. Like, so they'll give you fruit juice or alcohol or something like that. And that's something that they'll give to anybody, including a non-practitioner like myself. So again, it's a little more complex than just like we know which ones we're not supposed to see and we know which ones we are supposed to see because there are certain settings in which we're allowed to see them. There's also certain ways in which, different regional groups have different interpretations of those rules. So there are some places where I can freely work with a certain deity and nobody has a problem with it. And there are other places where people are not, don't even allow me to handle them. And then there's also issues where, maybe there's something that is secret or sacred, or a little volatile is the way that I tend to think of it. It's something that might endanger myself or the people around me if I'm going to work on it. A lot of times that's a great opportunity to collaborate with religious custodians, because they'll say, look it, we're going to come in and we're going to sort it out. We're going to do the offerings. We're going to do the rituals. We're going to do whatever it needs to be done to keep everybody safe, because we want you to do this work. And that comes with working at their invitation, and working within those collections. So actually they're the ones who are kind of overseeing thing. I'm just the technician who's coming in to like remove some insects or something like that. But the issue of care and the issue of harm and the issue of access, that's not actually me who's managing that.
Yeah, lots of different stakeholders to deal with, right? Not only the people that are hiring you and all of the religious people involved therein, but the audience that it's meant for as well. I'm curious, how do you navigate working with those specifically religious leaders? What does that sort of meeting of the minds look like?
Great question.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. That's a huge question, because it depends entirely who it is. It depends what their own unique interests, religious education, what their specific institution is. So if I'm working with a religious stakeholder who is the reincarnation of a saint and I have to work on his shoes from 3 centuries ago, that's a very different relationship. If I have to work with, you know, someone who's kind of a household practitioner, but who's not that particularly devout, but still doesn't want to have to lie to their mother about the fact that they're killing insects at work, you know, that's a different stakeholder relationship. But when it comes to the authorities, honestly, when it comes to any practitioner in any practitioner setting, and, you know, I'm speaking mostly about my Buddhist experience in Buddhist communities, but this is true no matter where I'm working and no matter with what I'm working, whoever the practitioner is, that's their expertise. My expertise is heritage risk management. My expertise is preventive conservation. My expertise is explaining how changes in the weather might influence the long-term well-being of metal statues in their current storage or something like that. That's my expertise. My expertise is not interpreting these objects relative to Buddhist knowledge. That's not what I need to do. That all being said, though, there have been ways that I've had to learn to kind of navigate those different, you know, systems of thinking, those different systems of knowledge production. So I wrote a chapter about it, but I can say it here too. There's a story in Buddhist literature that goes back at least 2000 years where there's a prince who goes out into the forest and he sees a tiger that's starving to death, and the tiger has cubs and she can't leave, she can't feed them, she knows they're all going to die, but he knows that all sentient beings, all beings are created and will return to the same, right? So he knows that all things are created and come from the same, you know, cyclic existence. And he sacrifices himself and he feeds himself to the tiger and to the kittens, you know, the tiger cubs. And as a result, he's reborn as a bodhisattva, he's liberated. And that's the Buddhist story. But the story, the punchline of the story is basically, you know, the first law of thermodynamics, that energy can neither be created or destroyed. It's just a version of it that's 2000 years older than the French / English version that we're taught to repeat when we study chemistry in a kind of Eurocentric paradigm. So it's an interesting conversation because it's a way to say, like, look at, there's a scientific thinking that's older, that's much older, much broader than just what we've been taught, you know, in conservation training or even through conservation professionals and standards, which have been shaped very much by Eurocentric knowledge production. So stepping outside that and saying that there are these other ways of articulating this relationship to material change or, you know, deterioration, renewal, even the value of material heritage, I had to learn that to start that conversation. And that was, it was an honor to do so, but that's a huge part of that relationship about being able to have those conversations, especially with those, if someone is in a position of authority, especially if they're a religious authority, to come in there and to not even know my basics, to not know some of these vocabularies, to not know, like if I were to wear my shoes, for example, to meet one of these guys.
Yeah.
It's very simple. And this is not like revolution. No one else is wearing shoes. You know what I mean? No one else is standing up and speaking to this person. Everyone else is sitting down while he stands. Like, there's just certain things that are just like, you know, it's recognizing parity in the expertise and saying, like, my expertise is one thing, but everybody else is coming here like as equals. And I need to listen as hard as anything else.
Interesting. So you mentioned that you studied theology.
Religion.
Religion. So, sorry. Yes. You studied religion. So I'm intrigued to know what kind. And you then mentioned that you are a non-practitioner. And so I would like to know your opinion on being or not being a practitioner and how that might affect your treatments of sacred objects.
Okay, I'm going to start with the first one. If I forget, you'll have to shoo me back onto the practitioner
question. No worries.
Okay, so the first thing was, so I studied religion, and I studied specifically religion, not theology. And the difference is that the religion is, it's more looking at how religions function as systems of knowledge production. So you're studying phenomenology, you're studying epistemology, you're studying, I mean, there were a lot of Europeans still, you know what I mean? Like, you still had to, I had to read Kant, And yeah, I had to read Levi Strauss as well, though. So that also started that anthropology thinking, and I think comes from that. That was my first kind of awareness of anthropological thinking, was through studying religion at this particular department and with William Darrow, amazing professor, incredible professor. But the thing that really got to me when I was studying religion was actually looking at mystic traditions. So I got really, I was really interested by Sufism, so Islamic mysticism, for example. And it was the first time that I started to see how completely unhinged and creative people were when they were trying to represent religious identity or religious experiences through material culture. Because you've never seen people be so creative. Only, I think, in sex or like current creative practice is it. You just see people just the imagination knows no limit, right? So that was the first time that I started to really think about religion and think about material religion as a thing to think about, because I was only 20. I couldn't think of it much farther than that. As for being a non-practitioner, so I grew up in a house where both of my parents had very strict religious upbringings in various ways. And because of that, they were hippies. My folks are hippies. Because of that, when I was born, they didn't baptize me. They're like, no, we're not having any of that. She's going to decide on her own. And instead, what I grew up with, instead of church and the things that they'd had a very negative experience of, so much so that they would be very kind of anti-religious sometimes, in a way that I would kind of have to ask them to stop. I was like, please don't do that. It made me uncomfortable even. But what they gave me instead was this incredible appreciation of the natural world. So we would can't I grew up in an island north of Seattle as well, where there's just whales and volcanoes, and it's just gorgeous. So I'm not a religious person, but at the same time, I would say that I'm an extremely deeply religious person. I'm extremely devoted in everything that I do. I am a devout anarchist. I believe it. I defend it. I practice it with everything that I do and everything that I eat or every decision I make. But I can't give you like a system to which that belongs necessarily. But at the same time, I'm interested in every system I've ever come across. Whether it's some regional Buddhist practice, whether it's some regional Islamic practice. And I think what I like most about religion in particular is that it's usually extremely subversive as well. You can have the institutions and you can have their kind of ideas about things they're supposed to, and they have their agendas. You know what I mean? It's always people getting in the way, right? But then actually, when you have people's unmediated relationship with their re religious systems, or with their ideas of their origins and their function, it's like that's them making their own objects half of the time. And that's why I like working on those objects. But also, it has absolutely nothing to do with those larger agendas. And then one last thing about your practitioner, so that working on things as a non-practitioner. So most of my experience, well, a lot of my experience has been with Buddhists. We're in, not just in Bhutan and the Himalayas, but Buddhists in other settings as well, Sri Lanka and things like that. But especially in Bhutan and the Himalayas, it's a very active relationship with material heritage. So you're constantly making things, you're changing them through action, through disposal, through practice, whatever. And working on things, and it's all, there's a lot of emphasis, kind of like in Catholicism, for example, where there's a lot of emphasis on kind of accumulating merit. So you're doing deeds in order to kind of shape your kind of spiritual well-being, right? So it's a very active tradition, and people will tell me constantly that even as a non-practitioner, by working on these objects, by investing on them, by volunteering my time and things like that, I'm accumulating merit. So it's good for me. Not only is it good for all sentient beings, so I'm participating in the bigger Buddhist project of universal liberation, which as an anarchist I'm kind of into. So not only am I participating in that project by working on these objects, but I'm also accumulating merit with whether or not I have what's called depa in Tibetan. So whether or not I have faith, it doesn't, it's still doing me a positive thing. So that has always been something that's really struck me back, because coming from thinking I'm an outsider to this and going into these communities, I thought, oh, you know, they're gonna treat me as an outsider and things like that. And I'm ready to be told, like, you can't do that. And people are perfectly good about saying where I'm welcome and where I'm not. If they're like, there's no photos, there's no photos. If you can't come back here, they'll tell me right away, get out of here. I'm like, fine, that's easy. But yeah, people are also just really supportive, shockingly, surprisingly, like movingly so supportive of me being involved most of the time because I'm volunteering my time and effort towards something that they have asked me to do. So that whole issue of whether or not I'm a practitioner, that whole issue of like cultural ownership, I've heard people use that language, for example. I've never actually run into that when I'm working in practitioner communities. It's only in, you know, Europe or the UK or kind of a Eurocentric knowledge production setting that I've run into concepts like that.
However, so you mentioned a lot of museums that have a huge colonial history.
Yeah. Including the one I work at
How
now. Yeah.
Drew, so how is it working currently or in your previous experiences with those museums? How is it working with sacred objects, and does the philosophy kind of change, the ethics kind of change from one museum to the other?
You know, I mean, oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, first of all, that's a really good question. The first part of that is a really easy one to answer too. So, it came down again to my research. Like, it had really serious impact on the way that these objects are researched, right? So, I would go into some more like the Wellcome Collection, right? Wellcome Collection is part of the National Science Museums Group. So they have a very scientific, very like artifactual relationship with their collection. It's there to teach. It's there to do. It's also massive. So they have not cleaned it, right? They have not cleaned it. They've also very poorly cataloged it, but that's true of just about everybody with a massive collection in the UK that was formed over the past 200 years. There's
Everywhere.
everywhere, right? Lots of lost things. We know that. But so you go to somewhere like the Wellcome Collection or the Pitt Rivers or even the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology here in Cambridge, and you're going to find objects that have evidence of use because they're an anthropology museum, because it's an ethnographic museum, or because it's archaeology and they have that kind of, you know, that detailed kind of what do I want to say? Like the analytic mind, you know what I mean? They're thinking about analyses and traceability and fragmentation and things like that. In a fine arts setting, somewhere like the V&A, for example, you will have absolutely spotless objects, beautifully conserved, shining, absolutely no evidence of use. All that smoke is gone, all that touching is gone, all that grime, all that contact, all of that, which you can interpret as accumulated merit in a Buddhist setting, for example, that has been removed. So that's more likely to have happened in a fine arts setting than it is, or to have gone through a fine arts dealer. If something has gone through Christie's or like Sotheby's or something like that, then it's a lot more likely to be kind of, you know, shined up a little bit. But in different settings, you know, it's going to be a little bit dirtier. And what's curious about that is in even different settings. So working with, for example, practitioner custodians, these are practitioners, these are, private collections in religious institutions within the region, so very historically embedded collections. In that working in that setting, for example, I'll have an object that'll have pest debris, and it would be something that I would normally remove in a setting like MAA here in Cambridge, you know, or something like that. It would be something that's considered debris. It's dirt. Right. But if I've been in practitioner settings where you have something like that, some kind of residue, something that's been in contact with a sacred object, and it's been in contact so long that it has actually absorbed some of that merit, some of that positive influence from that sacred object. So I've had people ask me to keep it. So cleaning in completely different settings, something that I would throw away in Cambridge is now become something that I actually have to work very hard to conserve and to return with the object because it becomes part of the data or becomes part of the value of the object. So yeah, it depends very much on the institution in terms of working with sacred objects at different collections.
But it does it did spark something in me, actually. This is all such a refreshing interpretation of dissociation that I don't come across often as a paintings conservator. And I'm curious if you have any literature recommendations if anyone is interested in learning a little bit more.
Oh my God, you set me up so well. So I just wrote an article about dissociation that's coming out in the Journal of the Institute for Conservation. The
Wonderful.
next issue, I think this month even,
Oh, great.
and it's specifically about working with dissociation at MAA here in Cambridge, because it's about working with dissociation en masse like that. I think we did, so I work with dissociation aside from pests are my two biggest, challenges, no matter where I'm working, whether as someone who works with Arc and Anth collections, dissociation and pests, that's it, and dissociation more than anything. So that kind of large scale dissociation, though, I mean, there's things that we know about, like specific collections, specific objects, like the Benin bronzes. Everybody loves to talk about the Benin bronzes, things like that. But like, no one talks about the Benin spoons. No one talks about the stools. No one talks about the garments. No one talks about all of these things that are so easily ritual objects. And ritual objects are the perfect example of that. These objects are so easily reinserted to lived human experience. They're so easy to reconnect with because we already know exactly what to do with them. They're supposed to be fed. They're supposed to be displayed in this way. They're supposed to be carried around the building, on the third lunar month. Like, whatever it is, a lot of times there are already programs of care where we know what they are. There are programs of care where we actually already can participate with them, where we can put them back into lived human experience and they don't have to sit in a box somewhere. So I feel like that's why material religion is just it's so easy. It's like, and it's so participatory, it's so dynamic. And I think there was a it was interesting. I was in Kathmandu recently, and I was talking to some caretakers there, some curators there, and we were walking around Hanuman Durbar, which is in the center of town. Many people probably have been there, and there's a big statue of the deity Hanuman, so the monkey deity, Hindu deity, and it's outside the gate, and people come to give offerings to it all the time. You know what I mean? And they put everything on. I love Kathmandu Valley because, oh my God, have you ever seen Care? Like, Care is coating something in butter and colored powder, and we're gonna do it every morning. So this thing is just like caked, you know what I mean? You cannot see the features of this sculpture at all. You can't see that it is even Hanuman anymore because it's so caked in butter and pigment. It's got robes on top of it. It's got flowers on top of it. It's got leaves wrapped around it. There's people burning incense everywhere. You can't get close to it anyways. And I was talking to the curator there, and we were talking about the fact that you can't see the historic object is an art historical problem. It's not a heritage problem.
No.
From a heritage perspective, that statue is thriving. The site is
Yeah.
thriving. It's extremely well cared for. It's not going anywhere and it's extremely secure. The problem of, oh, we can't see it, that's an art historical problem. So it's one discipline that we're actually worried about. But I think that really speaks about how conservation has been professionalized up until now, which it really has been a paradigm of fine arts custodianship and a little bit of archaeology too. Definitely, that's been shaping some of our ideas about artifactuality and things like that. But it hasn't. It certainly hasn't been religion.
All right. So sacred objects are very subjective to a person. So my question to you is there an object that you've worked with that has become sacred to you?
Oh, okay. You know what? This isn't entirely an answer to your question, but actually, no, it does answer your question. I once had a friend, a very good friend, who I had studied at SOAS with, and I think he studied like international relations, something I can't, something like that. But he once asked me, he's from London, he grew up here, and he once asked me in my job if I was afraid of the curse of the mummy. And I was like, no. I'm not afraid of the curse of the mummy. And he was like, but what if you're working on it and it opens its eyes and it looks at you? And I was like, if I'm working with a mummified person, I'm usually making an effort to improving its standard of care or maintaining its standard of care. And I'm doing that with the best of intentions. So whatever it is, whatever apotropaic rituals or protective, actions that may have been placed on whatever object that I'm working on, I'm going to assume that we're going to work that out. We're going to negotiate it because I'm coming to it with an open mind. You know what I mean? And if I get an indication that for whatever reason, I don't have the capacity to work on that object that day, I'm going to walk away from it. So there's something about the Curse of the Mummy. There's another way that someone once asked me is do you think, they asked me if I ever worked on an object that was haunted. And I said, all of the objects are haunted. That's all I do. And I've had conversations with people as well where we've talked about conservation as witchcraft, where we've talked about it as necromancy, as palliative care. I think of myself sometimes as a death doula. So whether or not any of these objects are sacred, it's like all of these objects are sacred, and none of those objects are sacred. Like it's a sacred activity. Like that's what it is. So I don't have favorites. I mean, obviously I see things that there are certain things that I'm just like, oh my God, this is the most gorgeous thing in the entire world ever. Absolutely. But it's the activity that is the sacred part. It's the act of caring. I feel like I'm participating in a long human tradition of caring for these things, and that I'm only one of a longer tradition. That's the sacred part.
Yeah, thank you, Aisha. Actually, that was a fantastic discussion.
I was looking forward to this because I have worked with so much love on so many different sacred objects, and I love working with material religion more than anything else because it's so challenging, and because it asks so much of me emotionally, so and intellectually and creatively and all of these different things. So I was really looking forward to this, and I was excited to hear what questions you were going to ask. So I was like, what? I don't know. Like I know I want to talk about this, but I don't know what they're going to want to hear.
Actually, one last thing, that's
Huh.
a very relevant question. How do you care for yourself when you're working on these objects emotionally? Because it brings that up.
That's a wild ass question. That's a wild ass question. I think I participate, whatever it is. So the other day, for example, I was at the Cambridge University Library, and I just happened to be with the conservator while she was condition checking some 1,000-year-old Buddhist manuscripts, really important ones. I mean, yeah, no, as you happen to do on your daily rounds. So much so that I'm speechless when I think about these things. And I was sending photos of them to my practitioner friends back in the region. But the thing that I needed to do, and I explained to her that I'm not a practitioner, but when I go into a religious space, when I'm working a religious object, I try to greet it maybe how it is expecting to be greeted, and
For
also
sure.
how practitioners would also expect it to be greeted. So, for example, in a Buddhist setting with this manuscript that I saw at the Cambridge University Library, and I asked the conservator before, would she mind if I did this? She said, yeah, it was okay. And I did what I know a Buddhist would have done in the same situation, which is I touched my forehead to the text. And I did it because I'm accountable to the people that I work with, to the practitioners that I work with. And I think knowing that I've done that is how I care for myself, is that I know I've, to the best of my ability, I have tried to participate. And that is me making an informed effort. And that's how I know that I've done a good job, or that I've at least had a good intention. And that's how I care for myself, because I also know that I am always going to be wrong, that I'm going to learn. This is going to be a lifetime of being wrong, of being learning, of revising. So I have to find a way to just say, like, look at I'm going to do the best that I can, and to reassure myself that I'm doing the best that I can at any time, given the resources that I have.
That's the best all of us can do, right? All
Yeah.
right, I know we're supposed to be ending the episode, but the act of interacting with the art, the religious art, and the way it expects to be acted with is something that I intuitively felt. I did my studies in Florence, and it was focused on Renaissance Catholic art. And I left the Catholic Church at the age of like 11. I really wasn't interested. And then to find myself in my early 20s in that city studying that art in particular, I just felt called to go to church, to seek the art in the context, not just to go into the church and look at the pieces, but to actually experience it in that way. I don't know what it did for me, but it didn't bring me back to the Catholic faith, I'll tell you that. But it was an interesting perspective, and I think that we as conservators do a really good job of challenging ourselves to step out of our own worldview, or at least I hope that we do. So hopefully our listeners have gotten some of that from this episode.
I was going to say, I think it also has to do with public institutions, and I think we've been engineered to think of museums and as like kind of an exception as a public institution, as a space that, I mean, and Carol Duncan talks about this, right? It was like civilizing rituals and things. It's not a sacred space, but it has become a ritualized space and things like that. But what I like is looking at all of the parallels between museums and religious institutions, because they do a lot of the same things. Like they have curation, they have collections, they have access strategies, they have collection development policies. Like they have a lot of the things that we would find in a museum setting. So I really like thinking of religious institutions actually as models, as model public institutions that museums could aspire to be.
So thank you for the good discussion, and we'll
Yeah,
be
thank
sure
you.
to include your information in the show notes below so that people can find you as well.
Thank you very much for having me. That was great fun.
I am here today with Venizelos Gavrilakis, who is a conservator based in Istanbul.
Hello, Ms. Fedra. Thanks a lot for your invitation and this nice challenge that we could speak for this very interesting subject.
Mr. Venizelos, could you tell me a little bit about yourself and your profession?
I'm a senior expert art conservator and restorer. I'm specialized on icons and paintings, while I'm also expand my knowledge in also other historic artwork. With my wife, Vaya Karagiani, which is also senior expert art conservator and restorer, we have the art conservation and restoration company Venice Studio, which we started in Istanbul, and now also we have expanded, and we are based also in Dubai.
Exciting. So, can you tell me what first drew you to the conservation and restoration of Christian Orthodox arts and sacred objects? And how did this calling lead to the creation of Venice Studios and your previous company, Ieri Parakatathiki?
So from a very young age, I was deeply fascinated by art, history, and ancient civilization and culture of the world. My journey to this magical world of art, heritage, culture, preservation began in 1994 at Mount Athos in Greece. And through my master in the art conservation and restoration, my first touch and learning on that path was the preservation of the sacred art of icons and any other religious art forms. Revealing and preserving not only their material beauty, but more important, their spiritual essence through scientific conservation and restoration treatments. And in 2012, this dedication led me and my wife, Vaya Karagiani, to the founding of Ieri Parakatathiki Labs in Greece, a specialized conservation and restoration laboratory focused on the scientific and devotional treatments of sacred icon and artifacts. Its name was the inspiration of the preservation of our holy heritage culture, which our ancestors left us. The laboratory became renowned for its expertise and its quality service for the art conservation and restoration of Byzantine icons, medieval paintings, artwork, and other cultural artifacts, both in Greece and Turkey. As far as our laboratory started to expand its activity globally, in 2022, me and my wife expand our vision to the preservation of the global heritage as an internal life aim by establishing Venice Studio, which is an international art and antiquities conservation and restoration company based now in Dubai and Istanbul, and serving globally wherever requested. Now, Venice Studio is offering a museum-grade level art conservation and restoration service, expertise in icon paintings, artworks, and other historical objects. So preserving, conserving, and restoring is more than a profession. It is a sacred journey, a lifelong devotion to protect, honor, and reveal the cultural heritage of humanity. For over 30 years, our mission has been dedicated not only to icons and sacred art, but to the global legacy of art, culture, and history, spanning from ancient masterpieces to modern and contemporary creation.
Your studio's motto, as I can read on your website, is "Where art meets eternity." And this is a phrase that beautifully bridges the material and the spiritual. How do you see conservators and restorers' role in mediating between these two realms?
Okay, the motto of any studio expresses the belief that art is a living testimony of eternity, dwelling within matter. The conservator and restorer becomes a bridge between the ephemeral and the eternal, between science, art, and faith, between matter and spirit. Every act of conservation and restoration is an act of respect toward the divine spark, inheriting its object, its artwork, ensuring its existence, not only for the present, but also for the timeless memory and faith through times and eternity. The conservator and restorer, as a devoted art doctor, transform time into timelessness, journey alongside the works of art in eternity, giving them the ability to continue speaking the souls of people across generations.
And in your experience, how does conserving and restoring a sacred Christian object differ from conserving secular artwork? Is the conservator and restorer's responsibility primarily material, spiritual, or both?
So, regarding to that, very nice question. Sacred art objects differ profoundly from secular artworks because they are not only aesthetic or historical, they are living vessel of faith. The conservator and restorer must treat them with the same precise and reverence as a priest handles a relic. While scientific methodology, chemical stability, and material ethics guide our hands, spiritual awareness and humility guides our hearts. Thus, the responsibility of the conservator and restorer is both material and spiritual, an act of devotion as much as of art and science. From the other side, I could say regarding secular artwork, we must show the same respect as we are giving to the sacred art object. So in conclusion, it's both.
Okay, and so what happens when a sacred object, an icon or a relic, leaves its liturgical setting and enters a museum or a private collection? What is preserved and what is inevitably lost or transformed in this process?
When a sacred art object leaves in its liturgical context to enter a museum or a private collection, a transformation inevitably occurs. The object loses its direct ritual function, obviously, yet gains another dimension. It becomes a universal ambassador of a cultural memory. As conservators and restorers, we strive to maintain its spiritual aura and authenticity, to ensure that even in a museum display, it continues to speak as a sacred entity, not merely as an artifact behind the glass.
Sacred art often holds dual identities, as an object of worship and as a historical artifact, as you've mentioned. How do you navigate the tensions between preserving the look familiar of the faithful and respecting the original material layers beneath?
In sacred art, authenticity is not limited to pigment layers or chronological accuracy. It extends to devotional continuity. Our ethical responsibility is to preserve both the historical truth of the material and the emotional truth familiar to the faithful. Cleaning too much or reconstructing without understanding the icon's spiritual role can disrupt this sacred balance. At our studios, every intervention is carefully documented, reversible, and minimal, guided by the international standard and ethics, and by the ethical imperative to preserve both faith and form.
And as I understand it, Orthodox iconography is deeply canonical. So saints are depicted according to strict tradition, and personal artistry is often secondary to the sacred prototype of an icon. So how do you balance honoring the iconographer's hand with preserving the venerated image itself without letting, for example, your own hand, your own aesthetic sensibility intervene?
Orthodox iconography is a theology in art and color. The iconography does not paint, but writes theology through his brushes, creating the icon. In conservation and restoration, we must respect the canon and the hand of the artist, but never impose our own. The icon itself is a meeting point of the divine prototype and the human hand that render it. Our role is to stabilize and reveal that sacred encounter, allowing the authentic light, not our interpretation, to emerge it. So generally, conservators and restorers are not having any impose any impact to the icons, and they mustn't do that. That's not in the ethical of the general conservation and restoration standards.
Yeah, of course, I see. And so, on a more personal note for yourself, do you see the act of conserving and restoring sacred art as a spiritual practice in itself, in your own work? Where does technique end and devotion begin?
Yes, for me, conservation and restoration is a form of spiritual practice. Each treatment is an act of contemplation, precising, and reverence. The art and science of conservation and restoration serve devotion, and devotion refines the art and science of conservation and restoration. In the silence of the laboratory, surrounded by century-old sacred icons or other historical and contemporary artworks, we realize that conservation and restoration is not only the science and art of conservation and restoration. It is the continuation of a prayer, a communication with the divine through the science and art of conservation and restoration.
Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've been listening to Fedra, Liz, and Aisha. You can find us on thecword.show or email us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com. Join us on Patreon or find us on social media. The intro and outro music is Spring by DD Mystic, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This is a Wooden Dice production.